all the good love. When we're all alone, keep it up, girl. Yeah, you turn me on.
WMFO Medford, and good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Voicemobile here at Tufts University. Well, today's a special day on several counts. In the Jewish calendar, it is Tu B'Shvat, the 15th of Shvat, the month of Shvat, and it is the new year of the trees, so we'll be talking a little bit about that. It is also an astronomical triple whammy. There is a blue moon, because there was already a full moon in January, so this is the second full moon. This is called a blue moon, once in a blue moon. There is an eclipse of the moon, which we can see partially from this part of the United States. And because of that eclipse, some of the light that's coming from the moon, and the sun is blocked by the moon, so you only see the red, so it's a blood or red moon. And it hasn't happened for, well, it was like the last time it was 150 years ago. So it's kind of cool. There's a lot of information about this online. You can check out some cool videos and such. And so since I'm talking about astrological things, there's something that I had actually clipped out another time to share with you, which I think I'll just do it now. Astronaut makes a spectacular landing in Newton. This was by Anne Green, and this came off of a site called Jewish Boston. Dr. Jeff Hoffman, veteran of 5 space shuttle missions, thrills 200 educators at Hebrew College and makes a dream come true for a space fan. On December 12, 2017, I met an astronaut. I had been invited by Rachel Vraz, director of the Early Childhood Institute at Hebrew College in Newton, to hear Dr. Jeff Hoffman, Jewish astronaut and 5-time space shuttle veteran, speak at their 8th annual Early Childhood Jewish Education Conference. Meeting an astronaut was a dream come true. As a little girl, I dreamed of being an astronaut. At some point, it occurred to me that to be an astronaut, I would have to be good at math. My inability to do even simple addition in my head, a condition that persists to this day, didn't stop me from being a fanatical follower of the space program. Even when I knew for sure they wouldn't be fitting me for a spacesuit anytime soon. My obsession began with a 15-minute suborbital flight of Alan Shepard in 1961, part of, and it looks like, Project Mercury. It continued through the exploits of the 2-man Project Gemini crews, who paved the way for the moon landing. I thrilled to the flights of Project Apollo, culminating with the first moon landing in July 1969, which I watched with a group of friends at a sleepover. My space obsession continued into adulthood. I devoured Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff and saw the movie, read Andrew Chaikin's A Man on the Moon, The Voyages of the Apollo Astronauts, and Homer Hickam's Rocket Boys, a memoir. I held my breath during the Tom Hanks movie Apollo 13, watched Hidden Figures, the film about a group of black female mathematicians who were invaluable to NASA in the 1960s. And of course, I've seen every incarnation of Star Trek, Star Wars, and any other movies that involve space travel. I visited the Smithsonian, 2 air and space museums over the years, and last spring finally made it to Cape Canaveral as a bug-eyed tourist. A high point was a display of lunar samples, which includes a moon rock you can touch, which I did. I thought I'd completed my mission as a space program fanatic. Then I met an astronaut. At the lunch at Hebrew College, I was introduced to Hoffman, a real live Jewish astronaut. Hoffman spoke to 200 conference attendees. He began by recalling his early interest in space exploration. He remembered his third grade teacher, Mrs. MacArthur, who encouraged his interest in space. I was probably doodling rockets, said Hoffman, but it shows you how a teacher can really affect a whole life. Everyone needs a Mrs. MacArthur. I really wish that she had lived long enough that I could thank her. This is one of the many reasons Rachel Raz had invited him to speak. I ask my students to think, where will their students be in 10 or 20 years, says Raz. I ask them, who inspired you? I encourage them to be like the teacher Jeff remembers. During his flights, Hoffman velcroed a mezuzah to his sleeping compartment. He also brought the atara, the decoration on the top of a tallit, from the tallit used at his son's bar mitzvah and as part of their wedding chuppah. His first flight took place during Passover. I thought about bringing matzah, but realized that any crumbs would fly around the shuttle, mused Hoffman. He showed a video from another flight, which concluded, coincided with Hanukkah. Hoffman had brought a silver dreidel and a travel menorah. During the flight, recalled Hoffman, I took the dreidel out and spun it to show my fellow astronauts. Of course, in space, the dreidel keeps spinning. The TV camera was on, but I didn't know that the CAPCOM, the ground crew member responsible for communicating with the astronauts, was listening. All of America, said the CAPCOM, would love to know what you've got and what you're doing with it. So, said Hoffman, I gave a spiel. Floating around the cabin of the shuttle, he explained the holiday to his international audience, launched his dreidel into its never-ending spin, and showed his travel menorah. The video got picked up and distributed worldwide, Hoffman told the conference audience, still seeming a bit surprised. For a number of years, Hoffman's rabbi had asked about the possibility of taking a Torah into space. Before Hoffman's final flight, he managed to get one that he could take. You can only take a few small items, explained Hoffman. So my rabbi searched for a mini Torah and finally located a rabbi who had acquired one. He didn't want to part with it, only for something special. I have a congregant, an astronaut, Hoffman's rabbi explained to the rabbi who owned the mini Torah, who wants to take it into space. The other rabbi responded, ah, that's what I've been saving it for. Hoffman showed the video from Space Shuttle Columbia, where he gave a Torah lesson. I have a miniature Torah for the first time on Shabbat in space, he said in the video. He explained the breastplate and the yod, the pointer used when reading the Torah. Then read from the beginning of Genesis. While the world looked on, Hoffman recited the prayer for travel, the prayer which is offered before Torah study, as well as the prayer said upon beholding the wonders of nature. In space, Hoffman read in Hebrew and English. It is appropriate to read this in the space shuttle, Hoffman told the world, to take the holiness of human life into space, along with my history and traditions. He ended the video with Shabbat Shalom from Space Shuttle Columbia. The mini Torah is today being used in a congregation in Houston. A question and answer period followed Hoffman's talk. He was asked, how did it feel on the spacewalk to be in open space? I imagine it would be scary. His response, it was fun. He added, during a spacewalk, I was floating on top of the Hubble telescope, traveling at 18,000 miles per hour. The same speed as the shuttle. When I turned my back on the shuttle, it was like being lost in space. Was he worried about getting back to Earth? Hoffman responded, I sat on 4.5 million pounds of explosives on the launch pad. You can't worry about what you can't affect. After his talk, a line formed of people wanting their picture taken with Hoffman. This fit-looking, tall, slim 73-year-old was a rock star. I joined the line, and someone took a photo of me and Hoffman on my camera. Like a giddy fan, I immediately put it on Facebook. Hoffman, who served as an astronaut from 1978 to 1997, is now a professor in the Aeronautics and Astronautics Department at MIT. He was the first astronaut to accrue 1,000 hours of flight time on the shuttle and performed the first unplanned spacewalk in NASA history. From my point of view, his most important contribution to the world is being the first astronaut that I met in the flesh, exchanged a few words with, and sat close to while he told his story. Rachel Rouse is working to put together a documentary on Hoffman to inspire Jewish children and educators to follow their dreams and to think about how they will carry on their Jewish heritage. She has a good question for her students. I like to ask them, what would you bring into space? It's a lovely article. So, I have lots of things to share with you today, but I think we'll go to some music. Lots of things going on in the world. Some of you may have listened to or watched the State of the Union speech and the response, of course, the State of the Union by our president and the response by Joe Kennedy. And it was all very, very interesting, is what I can say. But we'll be talking more about Tu B'Shvat, the New Year of the Trees. And I guess we'll just play some music. Why not? I did go to a wonderful concert over at the... Let's see, where did I put it now? Did I take it out? Maybe I didn't. Huh. Thought I had. The Somerville Museum has these wonderful concerts on period instruments with Duo Morisien, and there were two additional musicians. Let me see if I have my information here in front of me. We had Berju Gulek, mezzo-soprano, she was the vocalist, and percussionist George Lernis, and they joined the El Dorado Ensemble. It was spectacular. It was just amazing. The vocalist, her voice was just beautiful, and the percussionist was fabulous. So, and of course, the El Dorado Ensemble are great. So these concerts take place at the Somerville Museum on Westward Road. That's at Central Street in Somerville. They begin at 3 o'clock, and the next one is coming up in March, Sunday, March 11th, A Consort to Delight, English Renaissance Music for Broken Consort. And so that I will tell you more about that as we get closer to it. But if you've never been, it's a lovely place to see a very intimate concert, probably 30, 40 people at max. And there's usually a collation of wonderful little treats afterwards, coffee, tea, and treats. So it's well worth going. And they have a website, Somerville Museum, all one word, .org. So I highly recommend that you check that out. And I might even play something from Olav Henriks, who is one of the members of Duo Morisien, in a bit. So I'm going to go to something from Ernest Tuch. This is from the Milken Archive of American Jewish Music. And this is Jephthah. Rhapsodic Poem, Symphony Number 5, that we're going to listen to here on the Voicemobile. Okay, that was pretty interesting. That was Ernest Tuch, and it's from Ernest Tuch, The Bitter Herbs, and Jephthah. And the song, the selection was Jephthah. Let me see. This is on a Milken archive recording, American Classics. Let's see what it says for this one. Actually, there's pretty extensive liner notes, but we'll share just a little bit of it. It says, Tuch's last years were filled with creative resurgence and renewed artistic energy. And during that brief time frame, he wrote three symphonies, only a few years before his death. In the course of searching for an opera subject, he became engrossed in the 1957 novel Jephthah and Sin Tucher, Jephthah and His Daughter, by his fellow German emigre, Leon Fuchtwanger. The novel is based on an incident in the biblical book of Judges, and Tuch settled on that story for his opera. But as his grandson later related, he became so driven by the project that his enthusiasm turned to impatience, and he was ultimately unable or unwilling to wait for his librettist to make a workable translation and text. He proceeded instead to create a purely symphonic, pragmatic work inspired by and based on the Jephthah story, a rhapsodic tone poem. This became his one movement, Fifth Symphony, describing in abstract instrumental terms the unfolding of the biblical story of Jephthah, its tragic conflicts, and the emotional impact of its dilemma. The Book of Judges, Shoftim, is so titled in reference to its accounts of a series of leaders of Israelite tribes, or groups of tribes, during the period after Joshua's death, during the military consolidation and completion of the conquest of the land of Canaan. But prior to the solidification of the institution of monarchy in ancient Israel, these men were not necessarily or exclusively judges in the modern judicial sense of arbiters, but rather military leaders and rulers in the defensive campaigns against foreign encroachment and attack. The prevailing view among modern biblical scholars holds that Joshua 1-11 and Judges 1 provide two alternative accounts of the Israelite conquest of the land, and that the conquest probably occurred in a serial tribe-by-tribe assault on different portions of the land, as suggested by the Book of Judges, rather than as a unified and mostly successful campaign under Joshua. The eminent scholar Yehezkel Kaufman placed the period of the Jephthah story in a second wave of freedom wars, during which the Israelites were engaged in defensive battles against periodic enemy resurgence and aggression following the initial conquest period. In the biblical account, Jephthah was a judge for 6 years, during which time he was victorious over the Ammonites. Okay. Well, it gets into a lot more detail. I think that's probably all we'll go. These are great, though. The American Classics on Naxos. It's from the Milken Archive of American Jewish Music here on the Voicemobile, WMFO Medford. So, this is something that we should all be aware of. There are four rules of gun safety. No matter how you feel about current gun laws, everybody should know the most critical rules about handling any firearm. Rule 0. All guns are always loaded. Rule 1. Never point a gun at anything you are not willing to destroy. Rule 2. Keep your finger off the trigger until your sights are on target and you have made the decision to shoot. Rule 3. Be sure of your target and what is beyond it. A public safety message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. Yes, we hear, unfortunately, of a lot of mistakes of didn't know it was loaded and, you know, getting into the hands of children. Stuff that's really sad. So, I have another thing I want to share with you. This is about Israeli novelist Aaron Appelfeld, and he was He died at the age of 85 in Petah Tikva. This was from January, the week of January 5th, from Jewish Boston also. Aaron Appelfeld wrote dark spear novels that alluded to his experience as a young survivor of the Holocaust and a stranger in Israel. The Israeli novelist Aaron Appelfeld has died in Petah Tikva, Israel, at the age of 85. The author of more than 40 books of fiction, almost half of which have been translated into English, Appelfeld drew on his extraordinary autobiography of grit and determination as a child survivor of the Holocaust. In his books, the Holocaust is often a looming, sometimes divisive presence. Yet one of the hallmarks of Appelfeld's work is that he never directly refers to or describes the Shoah. Born in 1932 in Czernowitz, Romania, as Erwin Appelfeld, the author was 9 years old when the Nazis murdered his 31-year-old mother, and he was deported to a concentration camp. Appelfeld eventually escaped from the camp and hid in the forest for the duration of the war. It was in the forest that Appelfeld cultivated his abiding and lifelong affection for the marginalized, prostitutes, thieves, and fellow Jews on the run, who played a large part in his survival and influenced his fiction. He eventually joined the Soviet Army as a cook, and at the end of the war made his way to a displaced persons camp on the Italian coast. In a Paris Review interview, Appelfeld recalled that when he arrived in Israel at 14 years old, he was completely alone until memory stepped in and provided much-needed companions. No parents, no friends. I asked myself, what do I need? Why am I working in the fields? What will happen to me? Where is my life going? I had nothing. So then one day I made a list. My father, his name was Michael, I wrote that. My mother, Bunya. My grandmother, Mayor Joseph. Or my grandmother. My grandfather, excuse me, Mayor Joseph, I wrote. I was born in Czernowitz and my mother was killed. This list gave me a ground I understood. I was not alone. I still had my family. They exist in me. I made myself a family on paper. I wrote it down and they became real. In a 1988 interview with Philip Roth, published in the New York Times Book Review, Appelfeld recalled that although he often mined memory for his work, he had never written about things as they happened. All my works are indeed chapters from my most personal experience, but nevertheless, they are not the story of my life. Things that happened to me in my life have already happened. They are already formed, and time has kneaded them and given them shape. Appelfeld's first novel, Badenheim, 1939, published in Israel in 1978, depicted a summer resort outside of Vienna, which slowly became a staging area for the deportation of its Jewish tourists. Appelfeld's carefully constructed purgatory left little doubt that his characters were about to enter hell. Reviewing the book for the New Republic in 1986, Irving Howe called it a small masterpiece that was written as if recognizing a limit to the sovereignty of words. And the narrative is as furtive as the history it evokes. The unspeakable is not to be named. Excuse me. As Howe further noted, Appelfeld's overriding theme was silence. His language was terse, the dialogue minimal. I met Appelfeld a couple of times. The first time was in Boston on his book tour 2 decades ago. He had just won a National Jewish Book Award for his novel, The Iron Tracks, in which a survivor named Erwin had been traveling through the small towns of Austria since the end of World War II. Erwin had become a salesman of Judaica for 40 years, all the while searching for the man who murdered his parents. In addition to winning the National Jewish Book Award, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency reported that Appelfeld also won awards that included the Israeli Prize for Literature in 1983, and twice received the Prime Minister's Prize, as well as the Brenner Prize for Literature in 1975 and the Bialik Prize for Literature in 1979. He was shortlisted as a finalist for the Man Booker International Prize in 2013. The second time I met Appelfeld was a decade ago in his home outside of Jerusalem. In his book line study, he showed me his novels that had been translated into many languages. I write a very factual prose, he noted. There are no poetics or adjectives. I do this so that our imagination works harder. As he indicated in the preface to his memoir, The Story of a Life, his only work of nonfiction, memory and imagination have a symbiotic relationship. He wrote, memory and imagination sometimes dwell together. In those long buried years, it was as if they completed, as if they competed. Memory was tangible, as if solid. Imagination had wings. Memory pulled toward the known, and imagination sailed toward the unknown. Although Appelfeld was not an observant Jew, on that afternoon in Jerusalem he described himself as a Jew and a writer who wrote on singular Jewish subjects. Only a superficial writer deals with many issues, he told me. A writer deals with one main problem, reading in his soul. And a serious writer has a territory, a time, and a problem. Gabriel Garcia Marquez wrote about 100 years of solitude. I wrote about 100 years of Jewish isolation and suffering. Appelfeld is survived by his wife and three children. Very interesting man, in memory of Israeli novelist Aaron Appelfeld. This was by Judy Bolton Fassman for Jewish Boston.
Zum Himmel gucken. Hoffen sie von hinter Bäumen, Wölfchen im Rücken. Hoffen sie gelacht im Haben Schöpselach gebeweckert und dem Bastach mit dem Stecken nicht gekänder wecken. Du sparst doch der Träumer, hat zum Himmel sich verkehrt. Haben Wölfin hinter Bäumen, Schirren es verzieht. Haben Ziegelach gemäubeket. Haben Schöpselach gebeweckert und den Bastach mit dem Stecken nicht gekämmt erwecken. Wenn du sparst doch der Träume, hat daheim sich schon geglieben, seinen Hinterhalt der Bäume, Bündelach bleut geblieben. Keiner hat schon nicht gemerkt, keiner hat schon nie ich gebelket. Als er passt doch mit dem Stecken, mög die Erd verdecken.
Okay, that was Jan Pierce. The song is A Shepherd, a Dreamer. Jan Pierce sings Hebrew melodies. And it was the RCA Victor Orchestra. So, the Israeli Education Minister has ordered compulsory courses on Poles' collaboration with Nazis. You may have heard something about this, but maybe not. Following the instruction of Minister of Education Naftali Bennett Habayit Hayehudi, his office announced Monday morning that it had formulated a lesson plan for a special course in response to the proposed Polish Parliament bill punishing individuals for using the term Polish death camps. The course, titled The Involvement of Local Populations, Including Poland, in the Holocaust of the Jewish People, will be taught in two segments this week in grades 7 through 12. According to the Education Ministry, the lesson plan offers a variety of suggestions for relevant learning materials from the Yad Vashem website, testimonies of survivors, historical sources, and class discussion questions. The lesson plan enables students to delve deeper into the subject matter, with emphasis on the historical facts and circumstances that led to the murder of the Jews in Poland and in the rest of Eastern Europe, including the Soviet Union, as well as in Western Europe, the Balkans, and North Africa. It is a historical fact that many Poles helped in the murder of Jews by informing on them, turning them in, and murdering Jews themselves during and after the Holocaust, Minister Bennett said Monday morning. Granted, the term Polish death camps is inaccurate, since these were German extermination camps on Polish soil, Bennett said. But, as noted, it is impossible to ignore the fact that there were many Poles who collaborated with the Nazis, and we must make sure that Israeli students know this reality the way it took place. In the lesson plan, students will learn, among other things, that Jews who tried to escape or hide were handed over to the authorities, often by local people who sought to win a reward or hoped to take control of Jewish property, and some people attacked Jews with rage. The lesson plan also says that this collaboration was expressed through ignoring the fate of the Jews, bystanding in informing on and turning in Jews, and even active participation in the murder itself, collaborators. For example, about 200,000 Polish Jews were murdered by the Poles themselves. Had not so many civilians outside Germany participated in the extermination campaign, there would have been fewer Jews murdered in the Holocaust, the plan teaches. But the number of casualties would have been greater if not for other non-Germans who did not cooperate or even interfered in the extermination effort. The lesson plan also reminds students that even after the war, Jews encountered hostility from their former neighbors as they returned from the concentration camps to their countries and homes. The most famous case was the Kielce Pogrom in Poland in July 1946, during which the Poles murdered 42 Holocaust survivors who returned to the city.